And we seek to honor the Lord by standing for the reading of His Word. We find that in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes this morning. We'll actually be looking at the whole chapter, but I'd like to read verses 1 through 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, hear the word of the Lord. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. So may the Lord bless His word to our hearts and hearing this morning. Please be seated. It's been about 20 years ago now, when I think back on it, I was pastoring a church in another town, and we had a young married couple that were friends of ours, Tim and Vicky, and we had planned a trip to Six Flags. Our kids, at least two or three of them, were stair steps, and so we had planned this trip to go to Six Flags. Before we got to Six Flags, however, we found out that Vicky was expecting, was carrying their first child in these very early stages of her pregnancy. But she was an athletic and outgoing young lady, and she decided, no, I want to go to Six Flags anyway. And so we went, and she decided, I'll just be careful. I won't, you know, get on any of the serious rides and that kind of thing. And so we all assumed, as she did, that the carousel, the merry-go-round, would be the most innocuous and least threatening of all the rides that she could get on. And after a couple of spins around the old carousel, she was sick, 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 and wanted to get off. And we were trying to get the thing stopped. And so even the merry-go-round, the carousel, became an absolute tyranny to her because she was so sick. And I think that's what Koheleth, remember Koheleth is the preacher, the speaker of the assembly here in Ecclesiastes? I believe that's what he's saying to us in this passage in chapter 3. It's a wonderful passage. As a matter of fact, for 30 years I have used this passage, these first eight verses that we read, I have used that at the graveside of funerals which I've officiated, because it is so sweeping and almost mesmerizing in its overviewing the course of life. Look where it starts in verse 1. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. And all of life is compressed and reflected on in those verses till we come to the conclusion of verse 8, a time of war and a time of peace. And I think how overwhelming if we sit and meditate and think about the things that are said here. But let's not be beguiled. What we're really being told is that the merry-go-round ceases to be fun when you turn sick and you want to get off. And if we were to interrupt any one of these couplets that have a tension that carries them along, we say, I want to get off. When the healer comes to a time when he must kill. Or when we enjoy laughter, but we don't want to be pressed into mourning. And yet, irrepressibly, we are carried along and we are faced in these tensions of life with things that we simply cannot control. So the preacher is telling us as we come to chapter 3 that the quest goes on. The search for purpose continues. And remember what he is intending. That without God, we are distraught. Life is a riddle. We have no purpose. And we're carried along in such a fashion that we often are turned to sickness and distress and we just want to get off. And yet, we can't stop the merry-go-round. And he adds to us an added burden. And that is, if we introduce God into our concerns, it's not God as we think He ought to be. It's not God as we make Him up for our own ideas or God as we want Him to serve us. But he says, we must come to grips with God as He reveals Himself to be. And that's really what the main theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is all about. Coming to grasp and coming to accept God as He reveals Himself to be to us. So this quest for purpose, this search for purpose and the quest for the permanent is revisited. We saw it in chapter 1. Now we return to it in verses 1 through 8, that passage that we read a few moments ago. You can see that he starts out by indicating that in the various seasons and order of life and the world in which we live, there is time and there is purpose. This is under heaven, but it's not in man's control. It is directed by God. It is directed by an unseen hand. I don't know if you'll remember, but every time I read this passage, because I'm a creature of my own time, I go back to the late 60s, early 70s, when the Byrds took this passage and turned it into a folk song. To everything, turn, turn, there is a season, turn, turn. And they go through this whole passage, and it became a very popular folk tune. It's lilting and almost mesmerizing in the way it floats along. And yet, do you really listen to the words? You hear that tune moving you along, and then look at the kinds of tensions of life that are embraced in this passage. I think that's very much the way we live our lives. We want life to be easy. We want to float along on the current. We don't want to have to do much in the strenuous paddling of the emotions and the currents of life. And all is fine until we want to change direction. Maybe we don't want to go that way into a time of mourning. Maybe we don't want to go that way into a time of war. Maybe we don't want to go that way into a time of having to mend and sew up. Current is sweeping us otherwise, and we have to change directions, and we feel the strain and the stress and the struggle. Or maybe we perceive danger. There's rocks and white water ahead, sweeping us toward a waterfall. And that's when we begin to really feel the stress. When the current picks up and is carrying us, and we're struggling to go a different direction. Or we're resisting the unhappy events of life that come our way. Sometimes they embitter us. Sometimes we become complaining. Sometimes we turn on others. And sometimes we turn on God. And so, I believe this passage is so stirring once we really begin to consider it. Once we look beyond the cadence and the rhythms and look at what is being said here. It becomes a very disturbing passage. It becomes like the merry-go-round that is a tyranny when we turn sick and want to get off. That brings us to look at verses 9 through 15. You can spend your time, and I would hope that you would, in verses 1 through 8. I don't have time to give a full exposition of all of those couplets and the tensions that exist, but I think they're self-evident if you will spend a little time reading and reflecting upon them. But because we must move on, we look now to verses 9 through 15, where the preacher faces us again with who God really is. Not a God of our own imagination. Not a God that we use just to sort of baptize and make us feel good about life. If you'll remember back at chapter 2, verses 24 through 26, he introduced this idea of God, not God as he's revealed to be, but God as he becomes an easy reflection or an easy resource that we appeal to and say, oh, we're living our life in view of God. But God as we make Him up to be. And as we looked at that passage, it was nothing more than fatalism or chance. What is chance? But we say that life is an enigma. And what is fate other than to say that God is an enigma? I used an example to you before of the Fiddler on the Roof, the play and the movie. If you've ever seen that musical, I certainly recommend it. I would recommend that you get the DVD and watch it. But here's the thing. God, in that presentation, is a fiddler on the roof. This is the image of God that's presented. The main character is working through life. There's a lot of disruption in his life. There's disruption in his family life as he's concerned about his daughters and who they will marry and how they all have their individual personalities. And then there's disruption within the community. They're being dislocated. But all the time, there is a silhouette figure fiddling on the roof. And that's the image of God. God who is an enigma. Who is not a personal God. Not a God who cares and directs and is connected with the affairs of my life. But one who's just fiddling away while I'm dancing to a tune that I didn't pay for. Is that the view of God that you have? An impersonal God of fatalism who is fiddling life away while you're dancing to a tune that you don't really like? That's not the God who reveals Himself in Scripture. That's a false view of God. And that's a fatalistic worldview that leaves us in despair. And so we come to verses 9 through 15 to reconsider who God really is. God is ultimate, and God is inescapable. He is the Creator. He is the sovereign God. He is in control. He is wholly other. And we could have no understanding, no inkling or idea who He is unless He were to reveal Himself to us. Don't you see how gracious that is on God's part? Don't you see that voluntarily and willingly God has made Himself known to us? He is completely other. We have no claims on God. We can't tell God what to do. We can't make up God to be what we want Him to be. This is one of the things that disturbs me greatly. Many people have their idea of who God is and who they think God ought to be. We can look at it throughout the scope of human history. People have been very bold to talk about who they think God is and how God ought to be. And yet, it is the Holy Scriptures that cut across that and reveal God as He is. And we're very challenged. We're very challenged with that. Because God is other. God is not just a colossal human with colossal human emotions or colossal human foibles. God is not an open-ended being set on a voyage of discovery, drawing us along in His train. He really doesn't know who He is, but when He finds out, He'll let us know, and then we'll find ourselves. God is not an impersonal force of fate or life being that's taken up altogether in this assumed presence of life that's indefinable and some kind of cosmic urge. God reveals Himself in person, and God has ultimately made Himself known through the God-man Jesus Christ. That's the greatest challenge of all, because it means that we're not God. It means that God is set apart and separate from us. And God has sent His own Son, like us, to make Himself known. And our need, the need of forgiveness, the need of salvation, the need of restored fellowship, the ultimate, basic, and inescapable need. We need God. God doesn't need us. Look at verses 9 through 15. What profit? Remember, this word profit means what remains, what is lasting, what has permanence and substance. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before Him. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Well, I think these are very challenging expressions about who God is. If we're not careful, we can misread and think that this passage is, again, expressing fatalism, particularly down at verse 15, that which has already been and that which is to be has already been. But it's not. The intent here is not that of fatalism. The intent in verses 9 through 15 is God consciousness, that we are raised to a point of realizing that we live in a world that has purpose and that is overseen by God in ways that are beyond our comprehension. A good example of this, I think, is that of a tapestry. Perhaps you've seen a tapestry. I think tapestries are beautiful and fascinating. I really cannot begin to understand how the intricacies of a scene depicted on a tapestry can be woven with such detail and refinement. It's just absolutely amazing to me. But I want to ask you, if you consider life and the world in which we live as a grand and glorious interwoven tapestry, which side are you looking at? Have you ever looked at the backside of a tapestry? I challenge you to do that sometime. Because if you turn a tapestry over and look at the back side, you know what you see? A mass of tangled threads and knots. And yet, if you turn it over on the obverse side, you see a beautiful depicted image. And that's a very good illustration of life and of our dealing with God as He reveals Himself to be. Oftentimes, we're looking at a tangled mass of knots and threads, our lives and the lives of others. We don't see that there's a grand order to it. We don't see the big picture. And yet, to live by faith and to trust God, who is the Creator, Sustainer, and Savior of life, we know from what He has given us, the revelation of His Word, that indeed there is purpose and order and intent and eternity. Even here, Koheleth says that God has put eternity into the heart of mankind. Some translations say the world, and those are not at variance with one another. It's a way of expressing the same idea. That is, God has put a sense of the big picture in our soul. That's what is really being expressed. I sometimes use the example of a jigsaw puzzle. I don't know if you're puzzle people in your house, if you like to put puzzles together, but isn't it amazing you can take a box of a jigsaw puzzle and you can dump it out and there are scads and scads of pieces, little pieces with all kinds of little bits of color and image on them, and they make no sense individually. And you begin to try to start piecing those pieces together. And there is one thing that attracts and even can help you in being able to work through, negotiate, and put together the pieces of that puzzle. Not just the individual pieces and trying to fit them together, but as you begin to look at color scheme, images, and ideas, and where they might fit. And of course, you know I'm talking about the picture on the puzzle box. The picture on the puzzle box. That's what Scripture is to us. It's the picture on the puzzle box. It tells us of God's purpose and intent. Now, all the facts and aspects of our life are like the little pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. How they fit together. God brings them together. Sometimes it seems to be by accident. Sometimes it seems to be by design. And we're moved along in the current of life and all of these various and odd-shaped portions of our life. And by faith, however, the eternity that God has put into our heart, the wonder of the big picture that God has irrepressibly stirred in our soul, makes us aware that we're a part of something bigger than ourselves. And that something is God. Where do you fit? Where do you fit in the big scheme? Where do you fit in the big picture? Is it the backside of the tapestry to you? Everything is knotted up and tangled? Or do you longingly look at the picture on the puzzle box and just long for the picture to be finished? Because it becomes so hard to fumble with the pieces of life. Well, that's what Koheleth is telling us, that we cannot escape this one who is ultimate. That is God. He doesn't suggest at the end of verse 15 that we're really given over to fatalism. That which is has already been, and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. What he's telling us there is that what is the believer's hope becomes the unbeliever's despair. Not fatalism, but a sovereign God who is personally involved in the life of this world. I can suggest to you a little test. There are many people who don't mind if you believe in God, as long as you leave it within the church building. Don't take it out to your neighborhood or your community or your workplace or so forth. But here's a little test. When you talk to them about a God who is personal, a God who is actively, intimately involved and controls aspects of life, that's when you'll begin to hear objection. And that's where you'll begin to hear all kinds of false views of God. Well, a God like that would be a tyrant. A God like that would be an ogre. If that's so, then that means that we're just machines. We're just robots. We're nothing more than ants to God. He can just squish us like He wants to. You know what's sad to me? Folks like that have never heard, or at least have never believed, that God didn't spare His own Son, Jesus. That's the kind of tyrant God is. He gave His own Son to die for somebody else. And you know what? Jesus didn't object to that. Jesus, the Son of God, willingly accepted that charge. See, God the Father didn't force him. God the Son willingly undertook, voluntarily. It's the wonder of the cross. And those words on the cross that Jesus spoke. God poured out the full cup of His judgment on Jesus' soul. And if I can speak reverently, God gave the full stroke of His justice to Jesus to kill Him, and it couldn't kill Him. The full stroke of God's justice could not kill Jesus on the cross. But He lived. However, God's holy law demanded death as the payment for sin. So what did Jesus Christ do? After He had gone through that sense of eclipsing and separation from the blessed and comfortable presence of God, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" He bore away the guilt of our sin in those 3 hours of intense darkness on the cross. His soul was eclipsed from the gracious presence of God the Father. And yet He lived. The darkness passed, and He was still alive on the cross. And so what did He do? "Father, no longer a forsaken God, but Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." And He bowed His head, and with a loud voice He gave up His spirit. "It is finished." See, Jesus voluntarily died, the just for the unjust. Next time someone says to you that a belief in a sovereign God is to make God an ogre and a tyrant, you need to remind them of what Jesus did on the cross. It will make them uncomfortable. They may express their unbelief. They may scorn your belief. But to understand that deflates the whole notion that God is a tyrant and an ogre, a cosmic killjoy. And I think what we really reflect on in those ways is, you know, if God was like me, this is how it would be. If God was like me, I'd zap my enemies. And as long as you're my friend, things would go well, but don't cross me. If God was like me. Thank God, He's not like me. And so the preacher is telling us there is an irrepressible consciousness that God has put into the soul of mankind. He's put eternity in the heart. A sense of the big picture and a longing to find our place in it. Well, that brings up an objection in verses 16 and 17. Doesn't it make God unfair? Do you really think God, that kind of God, a sovereign God, a God who is personal, involved, and in control of the world that He created, do you really think that He's unfair? Look at verses 16 and 17. "Moreover, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work." This objection is we often meet, and that is, well, if this is God, if God is really sovereign, if God is really in control, and if God's not a tyrant and is really a loving God, why is there evil in the world? Have you ever heard people reflect on that or express that? I have a simple answer for that. You won't like it. Why is there evil in the world? Look in the mirror. You are in the world. I am in the world. Oh, but we don't want to hear that. It's always somebody else who is the problem. See? It's always somebody else's fault. Not so. And Kohelet reminds us, we are a part and time and place of a bigger scheme. And the story's not over yet. The last piece of the puzzle has not been put into play. But there is a time coming when it will all be made plain, and where indeed God will require an account of what was past, and that God will judge all. All. None will escape. All will be judged according to God's purpose and His plan. in the meantime, in the in-between time, in our time and space, God has been very gracious to make every one of you know how to find peace with Him. So you need to understand this. In that great day and in that time when you are called into account before the great throne of God, there will be no excuses. Even pointing to this day, God will say, "You were warned. You were told. How many times do I need to tell you? How many times did you need to hear? You are without excuse." Add to that, that God has birthed by your own existence, in your soul, an awareness and a longing to find your settled peace and place in the big picture. And you must know that God will not excuse you when you say, "Oh, I didn't know enough. Oh, I didn't understand. Oh, this and oh, that." But the bottom line will be this: "Oh, I didn't believe. I didn't believe it." You see, our main need is not to tell God how to do His job. Our main need is not to teach God. And yet, that's often the way we think. We need to tell God what to do. Oftentimes, I think even our prayers fall into that. Somehow we think we need to tell God what to do. One of the pressing messages from the old preacher in Israel here in the book of Ecclesiastes is this: not that we need to teach God what to do. We need to learn the truth from God about who we are and what we need. Let's look then at the conclusion in verses 18 through 22 of this chapter. And this is a very uncomfortable portion, because we're faced once again with a reality that we just as soon forget. The reality of death. The reality of death, which is inescapable and uncomfortable to us. Hear what he has to say in verses 18 and following. "I said in my heart concerning the condition of the sons of men," that's all people like you and me, "God tests," or better from the Hebrew, "God exposes," God reveals them, God reveals the thoughts and intents of their heart, "that they may see that they themselves are like animals." Now be very careful as we begin to read here. Our preacher is not a Darwinist. Our preacher is not saying that humans and animals are not different. Our preacher is saying, without being driven and submitting to who God is and God's order of creation, that we act like animals. And how would we be any different from animals if it were not for our Creator God? I think it's very foresightful here. He addresses and answers many of the dilemmas that we have pressed upon our own time in views of Darwinism and the survival of the fittest and that kind of thing, and human evolution and so forth. Listen to what he says in verse 19 and following. "For what happens to the sons of men," all people, "also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they have all one breath," breath or spirit, the animating principle of life. "Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity." If there is no God, Creator God, if He is not personal and involved in our lives, if we're not made in His image and bear His likeness and are separate from the plant and animal and the subrational creation, then what is there? All is vanity and empty. You're no different than an inchworm. What makes your life more valuable than a housefly? And remember, we talked about this and anticipated some of these arguments in the first two chapters. And once again, Koheleth is getting under our skin, because he's saying, do you really think that you're more valuable than an inchworm? Do you think that you're more valuable than some critter or bug that sneaks under the door and gets into your house? A spider up in the corner of the room? If you think you're more valuable, if you think your life is more worthy, well, the assumed question is, why? Why? Oh, you're higher on the evolutionary scale of development? Why? I came across a proverb recently that really struck me. I was have been enjoying studying some of the culture and the life of the Maasai tribe in Africa, Maasai land. And the Maasai are a very brave and courageous and warrior-oriented culture. Not in a cruel fashion, but in terms of their display of courage. And you may not know this, but they're lion hunters. Of course, they have been prohibited from the government to hunt lions, but they do it in secret. And they hunt lions with spears and swords, not with artillery. So they have to get face-to-face with the lion. And they have a proverb that says, the Maasai will master the lion until the lion roasts his meat. And it says that we're men and lions are animals. And it's going to stay that way. Lions eat their meat raw. Maasai roast their meat because they're men. If it's not a God who controls and orders and sets value and place in our world, then how can we say that you're more valuable than the spider? But all mankind, all men, women, boys, and girls will come before God, and all are different than the animals. Verse 19, for what happens to the sons of men also happens to animals. One thing befalls them. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity if there is no God. Verse 20, all go to one place. All are from the dust, and all return to dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the animal, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in all his works, for that is his heritage or his lot in life. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? And again, the assumption is, as we read these verses, if there is no God, if there is no Yahweh, if there is no covenant, personal, controlling, sovereign Lord who is altogether other and is not affected, controlled, or pressed by the tensions of the world of this creation as you and I are. So over and over again, he anticipates and suggests to us where we go, what we're left with if we reject a personal Savior, Creator, God. As I was reading this, I couldn't help, particularly in verse 20, to think all are from the dust and shall return to the dust. And I thought, you know, this verse 20, we probably ought to write it, each one of us, on our vacuum cleaner. I got a new vacuum cleaner and it doesn't have a bag. It has one of these clear canisters and it has a little idiot light on it that lets you know when it's full and it needs to be emptied, as if you couldn't see through it. But you're vacuuming, and all this dust is collecting in this canister. And it's pretty neat because you don't have a bag to fumble around with, but there's something kind of yucky about it. You know why? Because you have to empty it. You have to push the switch over, take the thing out, and you have to dump it out. And all this dust and grime begins to kind of fly around. It's so fine. And it just gets everywhere. And I look at that and I think Ecclesiastes 3:20, from dust I am and to dust I shall return. Is that all there is? Am I going to end up in the vacuum cleaner? I mean, is that all there is to my life? That's where I'm going to end up? Hey, apart from believing in a sovereign, holy God, I have no hope but to be vacuum dust. But thanks be to God, my hope rises above that. And as God didn't spare His own Son, but tells me, here's where I find a value. As I love my Son Jesus, I love you. You're more than vacuum dust. Thanks be to God. So I wait. I wait on the Lord with a hope to find my place in the big picture. And I hold out to you that same hope and love to find your place in the big picture. Who God is, His purpose for this life and the life to come, His salvation that is made known. Do you believe it?